Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Where else in the universe might life exist besides our own remarkable planet? Less than 20 years after astronomers even confirmed the existence of planets outside our solar system, they are now concentrating on the hunt for a world that reminds them of home, with the right size, temperature, and distance from its sun to potentially sustain life. Science journalist Michael Lemonick has been tracking the achievements of exoplaneteers. He explains how they are hunting down new worlds and taking educated guesses as to the conditions that exist on them in his new book, Mirror Earth, The Search for Our Planet's Twin. Michael, welcome back to Think.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You know, it's so ironic that just a few weeks ago, we were on the phone on this show talking about your book, Global Weirdness, about the strange storms, and now you are riding out Hurricane Sandy in Princeton, New Jersey.
Yes, I am, and New Jersey is the is actually where the storm is going to come ashore a few hours from now.
Are you in a safe place to talk for this hour?
As far as I know, I'm in my house.
Okay, great.
And the only danger is that the power will go out, if I suddenly go silent, you'll know why.
All right, we'll cross our fingers that that doesn't happen, and that you stay safe and dry and safe and dry and warm the entire time. I have to say, this book is such an amazing reminder of how much knowledge about the nature of the universe we have gained in the past couple of decades. What did astronomers believe about planets outside our solar system before they could actually look for them?
Well, they believed that it was likely that there were planets out there because. To assume otherwise would suggest that our solar system is unique in the universe, and scientists are very uncomfortable with those kinds of assumptions. It just didn't make sense to them. They assumed they were there. They didn't know it. But they also assumed that when and if we finally did discover these planets, they would look a lot like the planets of our own solar system.
So rocky planets in closer to the sun and gas giants out farther away.
Right, exactly.
And it turns out that's not necessarily the way much of the galaxy seems to work.
No, that's true. I mean, the other thing that scientists assume, you know, because they have no better reason to do it, is that our solar system or our planet is a reasonable model for what we should find elsewhere. But with only one example, that's a risky assumption. And with the very first planets discovered orbiting stars like the sun, they suddenly realized that that was completely wrong, completely wrong assumption. And I say that because the very first planets that they found were giant gaseous planets like Jupiter and Saturn orbiting so close to their stars that their entire year was 4 or 5 days long. So they were far closer to the sun than Mercury is to the sun.
So talk about 1995, this watershed discovery of the first planet orbiting the star 51. Is it Pegasi? Pegasi?
Pegasi.
Pegasi,
yes.
Okay. How was that find confirmed?
Well, so there was a Swiss astronomer named Michel Mayor who was not particularly looking for planets. He was more interested in looking for something called brown dwarfs, which are objects that are not quite big enough to become a star, but much bigger than a planet. Mm-hmm. So sort of failed stars, you could call them. And he was looking for them by looking at their gravitational influence on the stars. So you could see the stars. You couldn't see the brown dwarfs, but you could see the stars wobbling back and forth due to the gravity of this massive object orbiting them. Mm-hmm. And as I said, most astronomers assumed that there would be large planets like Jupiter at about Jupiter's orbit. That orbit takes about 11 years. So nobody was expecting to see anything in any kind of short time scale. But what Mayor noticed in his data was the signal of something that seemed to be going around the planet every 4 days, around the star every 4 days. And it made no sense at all. Just made no sense at all. But he checked his results. He checked them again. This thing seemed to be about the size of about half the size of Jupiter, and in the end, he could find no other explanation. I mean, his instruments were working perfectly. He ruled out any other interpretation, and he finally went public with this discovery.
And this,
and And instantly, other astronomers sat up and said, wait a minute, this is crazy. We're going to look for ourselves. And especially a team in California looked at that same star, and sure enough, there it was. There was this object. So it was not only discovered in the fall of 1995, but confirmed. And it was listed, it was the first time a planet had actually been described orbiting another star.
And then it's like a sort of gold rush in astronomy. Lots of people want to look for their own exoplanets.
Right. Well, so the other backstory to this discovery is that this guy in California, this astronomer named Jeff Marcy, who was then at San Francisco State, was deliberately looking for planets, unlike Mayor, who wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And Marcy said, "I'm gonna look for these wobbles." And everybody he knew, just about every astronomer on Earth, said, "You're crazy. It's too difficult. Mm-hmm. You'll never find them." And they were also assuming that he was going to be finding something like Jupiter. And as soon as Mayor and then Marcy found and confirmed this first planet, it suddenly struck these astronomers that, wait a minute, you know, these things are findable, and this is really exciting, and we want to get in on it too. And so there began a mad rush by astronomers all over the world to get into this suddenly hot and exciting game of planet hunting.
Okay, let's take a giant step back here in time, billions of years, and talk about what we have learned about the formation of our solar system. How did the sun come into existence, and what did that mean, that event for the clouds and the gas and the dust that surrounded it?
Okay, so the Milky Way, even today, has stars in it, but it also has these immense clouds of gas and dust in between the stars.
Mm-hmm.
And they were kind of just sitting there, whirling around slowly. And every so often, something happens. So an exploding star goes off nearby, or some sort of gravitational perturbation happens that causes this immense cloud of gas and dust to start collapsing. And once it starts, the gravity gets more and more concentrated, and it collapses faster and faster. And as it collapses, it starts to spin. And what you end up with is a kind of a spinning disk of gas and dust that is denser toward the center, naturally enough, because that's where all the gravity is. And when that central region gets dense enough, a hydrogen fusion reaction begins. It's essentially the same thing that happens in a hydrogen bomb,
mm-hmm.
except this is a reaction that's going to go on for billions of years because there's so much fuel. And so it bursts into to light as a star. So now we have a star, and there's still this spinning disk of gas and dust around the star. It's whirling around, almost like a CD surrounding the star in the center. And the star heat is very hot, obviously, and it starts to blow with its the heat and the solar wind, blow the lighter elements like hydrogen and helium and the lighter gases out toward the outskirts of the solar system, or of this newborn thing that will be a solar system. The rocky stuff is left behind, and we're still talking about little dust grains.
Mm-hmm.
But gradually, these start to stick together. They run into each other. They stick together. They begin to form larger and larger objects. And eventually, all of the, or most of the objects close in have congealed into rocky planets. Most of the stuff out further has congealed into these giant gas planets like Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus and Neptune. And interestingly enough, in our solar system, the dividing line between those two regions is the asteroid belt, where you've got big chunks of rock that have never quite managed to congeal into something bigger, and the reason is mostly that every time they go past Jupiter, it scrambles things up and prevents them from forming. So there would be, if Jupiter weren't where it is, we'd have another planet out between Mars and Jupiter.
But talk about a sweet spot. Jupiter also protects us from a lot of hits from this stuff, right?
Well, yeah, that's kind of a mixed bag, actually. So what we've now got is a solar system that has an asteroid belt just inside of Jupiter, and a huge disk of chunks of ice, the lighter stuff that got blown out to the edges of the solar system. And those chunks of ice are what we know as comets, and every so often they fall in toward toward the inner solar system, and occasionally they hit the planets inside the solar system. And so so Jupiter protects us from the comets. If they swing anywhere near close to Jupiter, it either absorbs them or flings them out into space. But the asteroids actually can get nudged into orbits that intersect with the Earth by Jupiter. So it really is a mixed bag of protection from comet strikes and increased danger from asteroid strikes. And over the history of the Earth, we've got evidence that we have had some very massive strikes by both asteroids and comets.
How did we end up with our moon?
I talked earlier about this period where these small dust grains were sticking together to form larger and larger objects. And at one point, there were tens of objects, maybe the size of Mars, flying around in the inner solar system. And again, some of those stuck together to form bigger planets, like the Earth and like Venus. Some of them stayed small, like Mercury and like Mars. And in one of the last violent encounters in that that new solar system was forming, astronomers believe that something about the size of Mars smacked into the Earth, one of those last remaining loose cannons. And it smacked into Earth. It melted the entire surface of Earth. The impact was so energetic. And it flung off a blob of molten material, almost like a droplet of molten rock. And that droplet of molten rock formed into the moon and began orbiting the Earth and solidified into the moon that we see today. And that's the reason, by the way, you know, if you look at all of the other planets that have moons, from Jupiter on down to Mars, the moons are much, 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 much smaller than the planets. They were almost certainly captured. They're captured asteroids or captured objects from the outer solar system. Our moon is very large in relation to the Earth, almost so large you can call us a double planet. And the reason is that it was formed in a different way. It was formed from the very stuff of the Earth itself.
So tell us about this term, mirror Earth. You write that we may be only months away from this. What does it take for a distant planet to meet the criteria of being a mirror Earth?
Well, it all I'll give you a vague answer. It all depends on how you define things. The strictest definition is that a mirror Earth would be a planet about the same size of Earth as Earth, with the same composition, so mostly rock with a little bit of water and gases to make an atmosphere, orbiting at about the distance that we orbit from the sun. And that is because at that distance, the temperature is such that water is appears in liquid form at least much of the time on the surface. And water, we believe, is an essential ingredient in life. So we're looking really for a twin of Earth in the sense of composition, location, and temperature.
Does it need a big moon?
No, not well. Okay, now you're getting to subtle questions. Does it need a big moon? Some people have argued that in order for life to appear and to evolve into intelligent beings, for example, it does need a moon because our moon actually stabilizes the tilt of the Earth. If we didn't have the moon, the Earth would actually wobble in place, and seasons would be unpredictable, and the North Pole would get full sunlight, and then it would get complete darkness, and it would be just very disruptive to the formation and evolution of life. On the other hand, if we didn't have the moon, the Earth would actually be spinning faster. The moon slows down our spin, and it might stabilize just like a spinning top for that reason. So that's one of those questions that's kind of, yeah, maybe we need the moon, maybe we don't. That's not clear.
Science journalist Michael Lemonick is here. His new book is called Mirror Earth, The Search for Our Planet's Twin. We'll come back in just a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is science journalist Michael Lemonick. His new book is called Mirror Earth, The Search for Our Planet's Twin. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Tell us a little more, Michael, about the habitable zone of a star and how that varies depending on the properties of the star itself.
Okay, well, so the habitable zone is that area I was talking about, where water can remain liquid at least part of the time, making it, as we think, conducive to life.
Mm-hmm.
And for our own solar system, obviously Earth is in the habitable zone, it reaches out almost to Mars, and it reaches in just about to Venus. And that's where our habitable zone, or as astronomers sometimes call it, the Goldilocks zone, is, because it's not too warm, it's not too cool, it's just right. But that is, you know, it is where it is because our sun is as bright as it happens to be. Other stars are brighter, other stars are dimmer. And so, you know, if you put Earth in an Earth-like orbit around a much dimmer star, it would actually be much too cold. The habitable zone is closer in because the star is not as warm. If the star is much brighter, you would have to go further out to be habitable. Otherwise, it would be too hot. So basically, it depends on the star's brightness and the distance from the star.
Now, astronomers think currently that there might be as many as 50 billion planets in the Milky Way. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. And that's based on how many we've discovered so far in this very, very limited search that we've done, and then sort of extrapolating to how big the Milky Way actually is. If we could look at the entire thing, how many planets we would be likely to find.
So what criteria do they apply to extrapolate and determine the number of planets out of that 50 billion that might perhaps be in the Goldilocks zone?
Well, so it's really all statistical. They look at the number of planets they found so far, find out how many of those are in the Goldilocks zone, and at this point, they have not yet found a planet. They found planets in that zone that are bigger than Earth. They found ones that are smaller than Earth, but they haven't found one that's quite like Earth. And so the assumption is that there will be eventually planets the size of Earth found in that zone. And you simply take the number that we know of and the number that we suspect are out there, and you kind of multiply and divide, and that's where you get the answer.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone now with Tom in Arlington. Hi, Tom.
Yeah, I used to work in bioastronautics at NASA in Houston, and I really do hope we find an Earth-like planet in another solar system. But I'm wondering if by the time we get there that these travelers will be a kind of transhuman that maybe has been modified for such long journeys and exotic planetary environments. Because for right now, neuroscience and genetics and nanotechnology are moving faster than what we are doing in propulsion systems. So we might create a human that is better equipped than we are now. Even the current space station crews, or maybe going to Mars for 18 months, it's very hard on the human body. We're not very evolved for it. We lose bone mass. We have radiation effects. They even use growth hormone injections with people on the space station to try to keep them from losing their bones and muscles. So what do you think is the future of ever going to one of these planets?
Well, astronomers really don't talk much about going to these planets at all, just because the distances are so enormous. You know, the nearest star, which is in the Alpha Centauri system, the three stars of the Alpha Centauri system are 4 light-years away. And to get there with any current propulsion technology that we have, even for a space probe, which doesn't require, doesn't need to be nearly as massive, something like the Voyager probe, would take tens of thousands of years. And obviously humans are not going to be going on a mission like that. And that's just the nearest star system. And we don't even know if there are Earth-like planets there. So the astronomers, you know, they're saying our job is just to find these things and maybe to study them. Once we get more powerful space telescopes, we might be able to study their atmospheres to look if there are gases like ozone and methane and other things that suggest some kind of biology going on. But that's it. That's all we're going to do. The dreamers think, okay, well, how could we actually get there? What would it take to get us there physically? And yes, I mean, there you get into the realm of science fiction, really. Not that it won't become true someday, but you know, one thought is that humans will be downloaded to or uploaded to computers, so they can live for tens of thousands of years. Another is suspended animation. I mean, anybody who follows sci-fi will be familiar with these ideas. Yet another is to build these ships, gigantic ships that have thousands of people on them, in which the people who set out will only be the distant ancestors of the ones who finally get to these star systems. So these are called generation ships. Many generations will be born and die before anyone ever gets there. And all of these are intriguing ideas, and the most intriguing idea of all is the one that we haven't yet thought of. And, you know, the other thing about traveling to these distant worlds is that you can imagine, say, 100 years from now, we finally come up with a scheme. We send off our spaceship to the Earth-like planet. You know, it'll take them 1,000 years to get there, say, or 10,000 years to get there. Well, 1,000 years down the line, we invent something better, which goes faster and beats them to it. So you can almost imagine a series of missions where the last one to depart will be the first one to get there and then just wait for the others to show up.
Why is the Kepler Space Telescope so vital to the search for mirror Earths?
It's vital. Interestingly, you know, you would assume just because the Kepler has found more than 2,300 very likely planets out there, many of whom which are getting into the size range of Earth, that its role is to find the mirror Earth. And in a sense, that's true. But the more important question, because just finding this thing, as I alluded to before, that's fine, but you really want to study it. You want to understand what's going on there.
Mm-hmm.
Just being able to say, oh, you know, it's out there, that's nice. But to understand whether there's life there and what the characteristics of the planet are, you need to study it in detail. And most of the planets Kepler is finding are much too far away to do that. So what Kepler is really doing, the most important thing it's doing, is finding out how many Earth-like planets or how many planets of different sizes are out there in a statistical sense. So they're saying, we have a sample of 150,000 stars. Out of those 150,000 stars, we can say confidently that X percentage have Jupiter-sized planets, X percentage have Earth-sized planets, X percentage have smaller planets, and here are their orbits. And armed with that knowledge, you then know how far away do I have to look in the very neighborhood of Earth to have a good chance of finding a nearby planet that I can study. So Kepler's basically answering the question, is it worth it to go looking nearby? You know, if Kepler says an Earth-like planet in the habitable zone, a mirror Earth, comes along once every 100,000 stars, well, that's a pretty big number of stars you need to search in the nearby neighborhood to find just one. If it says, you know, one in 10, then you know that you don't have to look so far, and you can very likely find planets to study pretty close to Earth with a relatively small telescope.
And the reason that a space telescope like Kepler and like Hubble is so much better than anything based on Earth is because they don't suffer from atmospheric distortions? Is that the primary reason?
That's the primary reason, yes. So you're looking for very, very, very subtle changes in the light of a star. Kepler works by looking at a star to see if it winks just slightly as a planet goes in front of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the whole premise. And by looking at how much the star dims, you can say, okay, well, that's how big the planet is. You know, a big planet blocks more light, so the star will dim more. So it's very simple, but if you're looking through the atmosphere, you've got all that atmospheric turbulence and water vapor that subtly changes the image. It's just very hard to make those precise measurements.
So it's funny that it's called the Kepler. Thinking of Kepler himself doing all of this, sort of what the human eye could observe even through equipment, how does software aid in charting these 156,000 stars that Kepler is keeping track of?
Well, Kepler is actually looking at each star. It's taking a measurement of each star every 30 minutes in most cases, each of 150,000 stars. So every 30 minutes, you've got 150,000 new observations coming in, and those have all got to be stored and plotted because you're not going to catch the planet moving in front necessarily at any given moment. You have to wait for it to come around. So it's going to. So for each star, it looks, and it looks again, and looks again, and looks again, and suddenly, okay, there's a dimming. And it watches that dimming, and then the star brightens again as the planet moves out from in front. And so it's a huge, huge database of information. And the human eye, I mean, if you tried to go through every image for every star, you'd need an army of people to try and identify these signals. So it's got to have a software pipeline that scans through it and says, okay, here's a candidate, here's where we need a human eye, come and look at this fellas. And humans do go over every object of interest, the Kepler object of interest, they're called, that Kepler finds. And then some of those are actually not going to be planets. They're going to be other effects that are making it look like the star is dimming for another reason. Maybe there's a big sunspot on the surface of the star. And as that rotates into view, the star is dimmer. You've got a big black spot on it, so there's less light. That can be mistaken for a planet. So each of these sort of suspicious candidates then has to be looked at more carefully by human eyes.
So you mentioned earlier that the planet orbiting 51 Pegasi is going around every 4 or 5 days. There may be others that don't orbit, you know, for years in Earth time. How many times does the phenomenon have to repeat and be documented before it's even considered an object of interest?
Right. So that's an extremely important question, because the last thing they want to be doing is following up on false leads. And so what the Kepler team has determined is that you need at least three passages, they're called transits, times where the planet moves in front of the star, in order to really treat it seriously as a candidate. And, you know, if its year is 4 days long, so you have to wait 12 days. That's not a big deal. But for a planet like Earth, you know, we go around the sun once a year. And if there's a Kepler out there around a different distant star looking at us, they're going to see the sun dim because of Earth's passage just once a year. So you would need at least 3 years to say, okay, this is not something to ignore. This is something we have to look at.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. An email here from Bill in Dallas asks, do new discoveries in which our assumptions about the size and dispersion of planets necessarily lead to any cracks in Einstein's theory of relativity? If so, in what areas of that theory would physicians seek to tweak it?
Well, simple answer is no. No, Einstein's theory is not challenged even slightly by any of these discoveries.
How much can we know about the properties of the planets that are, in fact, confirmed?
Well, again, it depends on a lot of factors, including how close those planets are to Earth, the stars and the planets. What astronomers have managed to do in some cases is to measure the densities of these planets. And that's really important. You know, if you look at the density of something like Saturn in our solar system, if you could build a bathtub big enough to hold it, Saturn would actually float. It's less dense than water. Whereas if you dropped Earth into that same bathtub, it would sink to the bottom because it's made of rock and iron. And so knowing the density tells you a lot about what these planets are made of. And in most cases, you have a hard time doing that, but turns out that that original planet, that four-day planet found in 1995, was found by watching the star wobble back and forth as the gravity of the planet tugs on it. Well, that tells you how massive the planet is, okay? The transit method that Kepler uses doesn't tell you how massive a planet is, tells you nothing about that, because you're looking for a dimming of light, but it tells you how big the planet is physically, how much light it blots out. If you happen to have a planet where you can see that wobble and you can see the dimming of light, you know both the mass and the size. And once you know that, you've got the density. And so astronomers have actually measured the density of a number of planets this way and found out that that is a surprise as well. So a couple of years ago, astronomers found a planet that looks like it's basically about six times as massive as Earth, but it's made of about 50% water. So it's essentially a giant blob of water with a rock inside.
Hmm.
And that's something nobody expected to find. Other planets have been found that really do seem to resemble Earth in density, although they are physically bigger. And so that's one big clue that astronomers are getting. Another thing they can do is to look at when the planet passes in front of the star, some of that starlight shines through the atmosphere. And you can use an instrument called a spectrograph to look for elements in the atmosphere of that planet. The light coming through and then goes into the spectrograph, and you can see what elements, what molecules are in that atmosphere that are interrupting the starlight. And so far they've discovered evidence for sodium, for example, in the atmospheres of some very hot planets, and they're looking for others. You can also look at light as it bounces off the star, from the star off the planet and into your spectrograph, and that gives you a different set of clues about the chemistry. So we're starting to understand a little bit, just a tiny bit, about what the atmospheres of these objects are like.
My guest is science journalist Michael Lemonick. His new book is called Mirror Earth, The Search for Our Planet's Twin. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in now to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is science journalist Michael Lemonick. His new book is called Mirror Earth, The Search for Our Planet's Twin. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Michael, how are the data that Kepler is collecting shared with astronomers all over the world? And then what evidence does any individual scientist or team of scientists need to present in order to claim status as a discoverer of an exoplanet?
Well, so all of the data are poured over by the Kepler scientists themselves first. They have first right to look at the data.
Mm-hmm.
That's because they're working on the project. And then, largely because it's a NASA-funded satellite, it has to become public. So they usually get about 6 months to work on the data themselves, and then they have to open them up to the world. But in those 6 months, they, of course, can look for the most promising signals, the ones that are clearest, that have the least interference from star spots and other confounding factors. They have members of their team who look for those wobbles in those same stars to try and get a mass, for example, for the satellites. So they try and get as much information as they can about the juiciest candidates, but they don't have the time or the resources to look at every one. So once those data are freed up for the world community to look at, other discoveries emerge just because there's so much. It's so rich, a set of data.
So there was talk a few years ago about the possibility of silicon-based life somewhere in the universe. Has that expanded the properties that scientists are looking for in imagining a planet that might, in fact, be hospitable to life?
Not yet. And the reason is that this is a theory, and it's an interesting theory, and it's been around actually for decades. You know, chemists, basically, biochemists have said, well, okay, well, our life is based on carbon. What other molecule could behave sort of like carbon in forming a lot of complicated bonds that are used to make proteins and so on? And silicon is one that they came up with. But it's just a pure theory. So the question is, what would that silicon-based life actually look like? More important, what would it eat? How would it metabolize? What byproducts would it create that would let us look for it? So for carbon-based life, we have a lot of oxygen in our atmosphere. The only reason we have it is that we have life here that is continually generating oxygen, plants mm-hmm. especially. And so one of the signatures of carbon-based life is oxygen in the atmosphere. Another is methane, which comes from the decomposition of organic matter. And right. methane would disappear from the atmosphere very quickly if we weren't continually putting more into it. So we kind of know what the signature is. But until you really understand the biochemistry of a silicon-based organism, and nobody's been able to do that yet, you don't really know what to look for.
Mm-hmm.
So the theoretical space is much bigger, but the practical space and knowing what to look for has not begun to catch up.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Ed in Arlington. Hello, Ed.
Hi. Love the show. The guest is great. Far be it from me to want to put a damper on this research, but I wonder if there's an important factor that's not being taken into account in deciding which planets might harbor life, and that is that life on this planet has required the existences of one or more supernovas to have occurred nearby in the past. All mammals require certain trace elements to survive. Primary among them would be, a couple among them anyway, would be copper and zinc. Without those two elements, even though they are trace elements in our metabolism, they're vital to mammalian life, higher life forms. And so I wonder if this research that's been conducted so far is being a little over optimistic in terms of what it describes as a candidate suitable for life. The Goldilocks zone there's more to it than that.
Well, what do you know about that, Michael?
Well, the caller is absolutely right. In fact, every element, or many elements in our bodies, many crucial elements, carbon itself would not exist without supernova explosions to create it. So a star forms out of hydrogen and helium, and it, in that nuclear furnace in the interior, it transforms those into more and more massive elements. And so all of the elements that we are made of, just about all, except for hydrogen and helium, were originally created in the center of stars. And then those stars exploded and spread their materials out through the universe. And it's those that make up those clouds of gas and dust that I talk about solar systems forming from. In the very first stars, you could not have had a solar system because there was no carbon, there was no oxygen, there was no silicon. None of those things existed. They hadn't been made yet. But those elements are now spread widely throughout the Milky Way as a result of those explosions that the caller talked about. So it might be that there's some patch of the Milky Way where that stuff hasn't spread yet, but it's pretty uniformly spread around now. And the best evidence for that is that Kepler is finding so many planets. It's finding planets that do almost certainly have rock. They have hydrogen and oxygen and carbon and silicon. So they're the best proof that those things are spread all over.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line, we have Jim in Waxahachie. Hey, Jim.
Hi, good afternoon. Hey, wonderful show. Just fascinating. And where do I sign up to get on the next ship that's outbound? I'm 65, so it may be a little premature, but anyway, my question is, it takes thousands of years for light to arrive from a star to Earth. So the data that you're looking at, it's at least that, whatever that time frame may be. So are you looking at verifiable, or not verifiable, but at accurate, correct information that may be a thousand, or, I don't know, maybe it doesn't matter, but that just occurred to me, and I'll take my answer offline. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
It doesn't matter that much because the planets, the stars that we're looking at for planets, you know, we have to look relatively nearby just because it would be so difficult to distinguish a planet halfway across the Milky Way. So the distances we're talking about are tens or maybe a couple hundred light years at most, maybe 500 light years at most. So you're talking about looking 500 years into the past. If you looked 500 years into the past on Earth, the planet would be here just as it is now. There would be people. There would be, it would look essentially no different, except the one exception is we wouldn't be broadcasting radio waves out into the universe. But other than that, we wouldn't be looking that far into the past. So no, it doesn't make a difference for these planets that we're talking about.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Email here from Steve asks, how might our social fabric be strained or strengthened if we had conclusive evidence of a near twin of the planet Earth? Have the scientists you've been working with thought much about this?
Yeah. They've thought about it. They haven't thought that much about it. It's one of those things that philosophers especially love to speculate about, and maybe theologians. But the truth is, nobody has a clue. I mean, nobody has a clue. When the Europeans first got to the Americas, and the people who lived here suddenly realized, oh my goodness, you know, there are these other people. That was a rude awakening, but that was largely, it wasn't just their existence so much as the devastating impact the invaders had on native populations. If we discover existence of aliens somewhere, the distances are just as great for them as they are for us, so it's not like they're going to come here with, you know, with their muskets and smallpox and trying to get gold. And so it's all, even if it goes from the realm of theoretical to proven, it's still kind of theoretical because all we'll really know is they're way out there somewhere. It might be that it will be profoundly upsetting to the human race, or it will unify us and we will have no more wars because we'll all realize, we're in it together or something. And you could read books that have every one of these scenarios. I just they're all equally valid, which means that to me, they're all equally speculative.
And at some point, maybe it becomes commonplace. I was trying to explain to my 12-year-old yesterday how astonishing it was for people in 1969 when we landed on the moon. And for him, it seemed so obvious that we could do something like that, that it made no sense to him, that people thought that was astonishing.
Exactly. And in fact, I've talked to some very young astronomers, people who are in undergraduates or in grad school. And for them, there has never been a time when they didn't know there were planets around other stars. Whereas when I was growing up, that was one of the great mysteries of the universe. And even for the astronomers who finally discovered them in the 90s, this was one of the great questions that had been around for thousands of years. And we finally answered this question. Oh, my goodness, it's incredible. And really a profound discovery for them. But for kids these days, it's like, oh, planets, come on. Tell me something interesting.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with David in Dallas. Hey, David.
Hi, good afternoon. Great show. My oldest daughter of four, which is why my hair is all white, she is a 4.0 student, seventh in her class, and studying astronomy and cosmology in college now. She's in love with the subject. And as her father, of course, I support her completely in this field, but I need to give her a realistic estimate, of what employment is going to be like. Can she make a living in this field? And I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Well, so I'm not. This. The best source is to talk to her advisors in college and the people in the grad schools where she might be applying. But I do know that the best astronomers get jobs, and they are gainfully employed, and there aren't a lot of the real danger is that her math and physics and computer skills will be so much in demand from investment banks and hedge funds that they'll lure her away with huge amounts of money, which probably would make the father happy.
A problem every dad would like to have for his daughter.
Yeah. But no, there are jobs out there.
Can you talk a little bit about the cooperative yet competitive nature of the astronomers who are doing this work today?
Sure. Well, I mean, of course, you know, everybody wants to make great discoveries for themselves, and there's a lot of street credibility for those who do that. And so the first person who discovers a real mirror Earth will, you know, be on the front page of the newspaper and will be in the headlines, will be quoted everywhere. So there is a competitive spirit to this. And, you know, once Jeff Marcy, this guy in California, found his first planet, well, he had to find some more, and then he had to find some more. And he knew that something like the Kepler mission was coming and that other astronomers were going to get into this business and start finding things on their own now that he had proven it was possible. And so his attitude was, I'm going to find as many of these things as I can before everyone else catches up to me. And yes, that is important for the science. The more planets you have to look at, the better a sense you can get of what that world of planets is like, you know, how many of different kinds there are. But there's also a sense of real achievement and triumph. So there's competition, and yet these people do know each other, and they're not going to give each other their secret data, but they will cheer their fellows on. You know, they might be grumbling a little bit, you know, behind their napkin, saying, "I should have found that first." But generally, they do like and admire each other, and they are. Competitors in a positive sense.
And we're maybe possibly months away from finding something that could be called a mirror Earth?
Well, we are in principle. And the thing is that nobody knows for sure when this is going to happen. And one thing that the Kepler mission discovered, you know, I mentioned that some things can masquerade as planets. And one problem is that if stars have a lot of solar flares on them, like our sun does, but if they have a lot more or a lot more sunspots, it gets more difficult. And what they discovered was that our star is actually unusually quiet. And so the stars out there are noisier and a little bit harder to read than they'd expected. In fact, NASA had only authorized 3.5 years worth of observations before they were going to shut Kepler down. And if they hadn't authorized another 3.5 or 4 years, the discovery of a mirror Earth might have not happened.
Michael Lemonick, I'm so sorry we're out of time. The new book is called Mirror Earth, The Search for Our Planet's Twin. Michael, thank you so much and stay safe.
I will. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin, phones answered by Lindsay Connect. I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.